ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now. And sometimes it can be hard to cut through all the noise from the Canberra bubble. But on the Politics Now podcast, bursting it wide open is our core business. I'm joined by the brightest minds at the ABC to break down the poly speak and have a chat about what's actually going on behind the scenes. It's called Politics Now, and you can find it on ABC Listen.
Well, it's another Monday and some fresh property data to digest. Property sales continue to slow, with the latest data from Cotality showing a drop in auction clearance rates. Meanwhile, a new report into Australia's tax system says young people are carrying more than their fair share of the load. And did Friday's Senate inquiry into KPMG mark a major milestone in holding the professional services firm to account? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yander.
Michael, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
I feel like week in, week out at the moment, this Cotality data that we get is pretty interesting.
I love the property market, but even for me, sometimes it feels repetitive to come in here and talk about auction clearance rates.
I think the reason we're so fixated is, A, obviously it is so important to Australians' feeling of wealth. I think it's 2/3 of Australian wealth is in property, but it's also a particularly interesting time because we have the government trying to get its tax changes passed through the parliament. So this is the CGT and negative gearing changes.
This week, from their point of view, hopefully for them.
Exactly. And I think how this is playing out politically is really interesting, because you can tell the government is slightly unsure of whether or not to claim a victory in property price, the property market seemingly continuing to slow, versus being concerned about talking up their influence on it too much.
Yeah, so, well, there was an interesting article in one of our competitor publications, the Sydney Morning Herald, Shane Wright, an excellent economics correspondent, looking at this polling that they'd had done, which showed that a majority of Australians, including a majority of current homeowners, wanted to see property prices fall. And a very small minority were actively opposed, with quite a big group then sitting in between the two and kind of unsure. Caveat there is, it's always one thing to ask people what they want to happen, but when they go and try and sell their property and the real estate agent says you're probably going to get a couple hundred grand less, do they feel the same way? And that's probably what the government's weighing up in this.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, I think most Australians probably like the idea of property being more affordable. But when you try to break down what does that actually mean, do you actually want your house to be worth less? I think most people would be a little bit more hesitant on that question.
That said, of course, if you're just an owner-occupier and the only property real estate that you own is the house you live in, then for most people, if they sell it and they buy another house, and both fall by the same percentage, give or take, it makes no difference whatsoever. In fact, for someone like me who's in a position where maybe I need a bigger house because I've got a few kids, and when they get bigger, I need more space, it might actually be a benefit, because in dollar terms, the more expensive, bigger house is going to have bigger fall than the house I'm currently in.
But that can be the problem. So I think it absolutely depends on your stage of life. So yes, it might make sense for somebody who wants to upsize and get an extra couple of bedrooms. But if you're somebody who is facing an empty nest, you might actually, you'd still be more upset about property prices falling even in percentage terms, because you won't bank that extra bit of equity. And if you're downsizing, that, you know, you're not going to get as much money in your bank account potentially.
So even then, depends where you're downsizing to. If you want to go to a coastal lifestyle market, maybe you'll get an even bigger discount there, because there's a lot of properties, you know, what really are people's holiday homes, but they rent them out enough to try and claim them and claim the negative gearing on them, which the tax office has already been tightening down on. But with these rule changes, that strategy is out the window, because you can't negatively gear it. So if you want to retire to a coastal market, might even be good news for you in terms of property prices.
So let's look at this latest data. And I agree with you. In some ways, people might be like, I feel like we keep hearing this same story because we keep talking about clearance rates being the lowest since April 2020, which, remember, is the COVID period. But it is a lower again. The big headline this week was Tim Lawless suggesting that actually the final auction clearance rate, so these are preliminary figures that we're focused on, the final rate, which we'll get in a couple of days, might actually be below 40%. Now, there is this very crude rule of thumb, which is below 60%, people say that probably means prices are falling. If it's above 60%, prices are probably going up. And it is interesting watching how these trends work. But I think there can be no doubt at this point that both the interest rate rises that we've seen this year, but also then the speculation about the potential tax changes, which were then realized when we had the budget announcement, coupled with what's happening when it comes to inflationary pressures, kind of weariness about what's happening
globally.
Until
recently, the fear that there could be one or two more rate rises, although maybe less likely now.
Well, I want to go on the interest rate predictions because I think they are interesting. But it's pretty clear, isn't it, that there has been a marked shift in the property market between late last year and early this year, and we've seen this play out. There definitely doesn't seem to be as much speculative activity in the property market. People aren't just piling in there as a one-way bet when it comes to
And a lot less panic buying as well, Carrington.
Yes,
not
exactly.
So you've got the investors with the speculation, but in terms of the owner-occupiers and first-home buyers, there's fewer people feeling like, I have to rush in now or I'll never get in, because the prices do seem to be coming down rather than going up.
I think that's exactly right. I think people have more time up their sleeve. And many people are thinking, well, I'm hearing people talk about prices are going to actually fall this year, maybe continue to fall next year, maybe I wait. They've got more time to negotiate. There's not that fear of missing out that we were really seeing late last year. But the question does become, how low can they go? And so all the data shows that we have a very low vacancy rate when it comes to rental properties in Australia. We've also seen rental costs continuing to rise at really an extraordinary rate. And that probably means, doesn't it, that there is only so far that property prices can fall because those rental prices are so high, people are still going to want to buy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the analysis around particularly the negative gearing changes sort of indicated that it might be worth 3, perhaps even 4 interest rate hikes for investors in terms of the extra cost because of not being able to write off those losses immediately against their other income. That is for new investors who aren't grandfathered. So people are factoring that into their decision, which is why you're seeing investors drop out of the market. But of course, you're right, Carrington, if rents keep growing, that goes some way to making up that investment return gap. And eventually, you will see investors come back into the market. There's also a couple of other factors that are really interesting in this totality data that struck me. Nearly a quarter of scheduled auctions were withdrawn. So, you know, the clearance rate's low enough as it is, but a quarter of properties didn't make it to auction. About half of those were sold prior to auction. And so that's quite telling because that tells you that the sellers were like, you know,
they didn't want to roll the dice.
Bird in hand rather than two in the bush. Yes, we might get a better price at auction, but I'd rather take what I can get now, because if you go to auction and fail, any prospective buyers are going to be in a much stronger negotiating position, knowing that there's no one else out there, you know, in the ballpark. The other factor that could put, as you say, a bit of a floor under the property price fall, and this is what usually happens when property prices fall in Australia, and particularly when the jobs market is still relatively strong and you don't see many forced sales, is that we're seeing fewer properties go to auction. So we saw an 11% drop on the previous week and nearly 7% lower in terms of properties going to auction than the same week a year earlier. We could start seeing eventually listings fall, and then the supply of properties available for sale that prospective buyers have to choose from start shrinking, and that tends to start putting a bit of a floor under price falls because there are still people who want to buy, and if there's fewer people wanting to sell, that supply-demand equation evens up.
A few other economic consequences of a slowdown in the property market, because it's about turnover, obviously real estate agents, the first people to be hit, and all those industries attached to real estate and selling properties, they're all hit very quickly. But also, you know, spare a thought for state governments who rely heavily on stamp duty.
Queensland's out today, I believe, and I think New South Wales' budget is out tomorrow. So two of the biggest states coming out, and too early to see the impact yet, but I wonder what their forecasts will be for stamp duty.
We'll be seeing them hit, and of course, the finance industry banks are going to be making less profit. The framing of these changes regarding capital gains tax and negative gearing was partly about intergenerational equity. And we do have this new Actuaries Institute report, which is a spotlight on the Australian tax and transfer system. And shout out to our colleague, Gareth Hutchins, who's written this up very comprehensively, and you can see it on the website, the ABC website. But it is fascinating to look at how the Australian tax system treats people in different age cohorts. And this is, I must say, one of the big themes that we were hearing from the Treasurer and the Prime Minister on the night of the budget. What surprised you about this particular report, if anything?
Wasn't wholly surprising as someone who is an economist and looks at this sort of stuff regularly. Disappointing for me with my 43rd birthday coming up in a few months that 43-year-olds are the biggest taxpayers in Australia.
Right.
One striking figure from this report is that if you have two people on the same total gross income of $100,000 a year, one aged 30 years old, so probably someone who doesn't yet necessarily have kids, past getting the benefit of any kind of free or subsidised education, now in the workforce earning a decent income, versus someone aged 71 and probably in retirement and maybe starting to draw down some part pension or even full pension, etc. Well, not if they're on $100,000 a year, but they might be getting a little bit of part pension depending where their income comes from. But the 30-year-old, they end up with about $85,700 after they pay their tax minus whatever they get back from the government in terms of services and, you know, government payments. The 71-year-old ends up with a net income of $128,100 because they're getting a lot more back from the government compared to what they're contributing in tax. Because if their income is coming from superannuation in the retirement phase, then with that kind of income level, it's pretty much all tax-free. And they're potentially getting a part pension as well on top of that. Mm. Plus, they're getting a lot more healthcare spending starting to go on them. As they get older still, they're getting a lot more than aged care and other health-related spending coming in. So the older people get, the more they cost the government to look after, they're not any longer really contributing in tax. So you've got this really big bulge in the middle where, you know, because we're relying so much on income tax, middle-aged people, and particularly middle-aged people without children, are really carrying the burden of paying the tax. And
And I think what's interesting about this is, on one hand, this is totally understandable. And I think our system has been set up for decades to basically say people contribute when they're working age, in kind of inverted commas, and then when you're no longer able to contribute in that way, then the state looks after you, that we all kind of pitch in. And that's how the system should work, that people get to a certain point in their life, they should be supported by others because they've worked hard at times before that, or we just accept that there's a certain age where we're not expecting you to lift as much, right? But the question becomes, is that sustainable with people living for a lot longer? And also because of the makeup of our societies now, and the ratio of how many people are having children. And one of the things that was interesting to me that they pointed out is that, you know, the means testing for the pension is much more generous than for the working age benefits like JobSeeker, for example. It's much more difficult to get JobSeeker, even if you're not currently employed, if you have assets, etc., than it is to get a part pension when you have passed the retirement age. And there is a fairness question there. But that, I guess, starting question is it a bad thing if older people are being more supported than younger people? Because hopefully almost all of us will get old one day.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a good question, but the key point you made there is around sustainability. And this is a key point in this actuary's report, because they've looked at what the average Australian pays over their lifetime. And currently the average Australian over our lifetime is only paying about 73% of the cost of what we take out. Now, it doesn't take an actuary to figure out that that isn't sustainable. In fact, the only way they say that it has been sustainable is that because we've had such strong migration and previously had, you know, reasonably good demographics, and Australia's a bit younger relative to some other developed countries, we've managed to prop it up by having enough working age people. But as you say, as the population keeps aging, and particularly if we do really clamp down on the total population growth through net migration, we're going to run out of working age people to keep being able to subsidise that. They say we need to get to 85 to 90% of that lifetime cost being covered by people. So that means either fewer services or lower quality services, or we need to find some more taxes, maybe not just from working age people, but from retired people who have a lot of assets but are currently not paying much tax.
Zooming out, the hope would be AI, robotics will mean that we don't all have to take up that burden, that there'll be ways of using new technology to provide some of these services without needing as big an aspect of labour in that, right? So you kind of have two divergent views now. You've got the Elon Musk worldview, which is actually abundance is going to be our problem pretty shortly, because actually most jobs will be able to be done by robotics and AI. And so what people will need to be focused on is trying to figure out a way to fill their time because we'll have so much abundance. Versus the kind of negative view, which is that we have, and also an Elon Musk view, that we have such falling population rates that actually there's going to be a whole bunch of old people being supported by very few young people, and that is going to throw the tax system into even greater disarray.
And my parting thought there on this topic would be, who gets that abundance?
Yeah.
Because if that abundance comes to pass, but it only belongs to a handful of billionaires, or now, shall we say, trillionaires, that's going to result in some severe societal collapse, because you're not going to have these working age people who are working to pay the tax, to pay for all this robotic support.
I mean, it's a very interesting report. I would highly suggest people going and reading Gareth's work on the website. But I do want to get your take on the KPMG inquiry we saw last Friday. So this was well signposted, led by Senator Deb O'Neill, who's kind of been leading the charge on the KPMG scandal. She was the one under parliamentary privilege that first outed the treatment of this KPMG whistleblower. They had a pretty impressive roll call of both current and former members of the KPMG team. There's obviously a certain element of parliamentary grandstanding, but was there anything that came from this inquiry that you think has moved the dial on this scandal?
Look, I think the general outrage, which we saw before the hearing, that certainly hasn't died down. And if anything, that's ramped up. We heard first from Lendlease, which is the alleged victim of this theft of confidential information, who used KPMG as their auditors for 68 years.
Yeah.
Now, there's some side questions there about using the same auditor for nearly seven decades,
yes,
but 68 years, and are now terminating that relationship going forward. So already there's one major corporate client longstanding that KPMG has lost, and it won't be the last. I think there's also, you know, the other broader takeaway issues around this argument about legal professional privilege, which extends beyond these professional services firms. The accusation from the parliamentarians was that KPMG was using its two external law firms and this privilege as a shield,
yes,
to cover up its own wrongdoings and incompetence in handling this whistleblower claim, by basically, you know, denying that investigations had taken place and putting it under the privilege of advice, because advice is protected, but investigations and consulting is not. Yet when we heard from former KPMG...
Because I think this is such an interesting point. So the argument is, so KPMG has this scandal. They then go to an outside law firm. They say they were asking for legal advice, so that therefore that is covered by legal privilege, and therefore they don't have to hand that over to outside people, for example.
Including the parliamentary committee, which was a point of major contention. And it was fascinating. It was one of the most interesting areas of discussion, particularly over the afternoon, because we had former independent director of KPMG and former New South Wales Premier Mike Baird as one of the witnesses. He left the board in September last year, mostly because of a restructuring KPMG that would have made the board position much more onerous, and he has other commitments. He said, look, I just didn't have the time. But he said, look, it was also a factor, this ongoing issue with this whistleblower investigation. And he'd been, as he said, unhappy about how it had been handled. And before he departed, he sought assurances and was comforted by the fact that, in his own words, KPMG was getting an external investigation into this, external inquiry into this. So certainly in his mind, as he put it to the committee, this was more than seeking pure legal advice. This was an external law firm coming in to investigate what had happened with this whistleblower and how they'd been treated. So, and two of the other current independent directors were also quite clear that their opinions as independent directors was to the committee was that this advice or investigation should be handed over to the parliamentary committee. So you've got KPMG, the corporate entity, defying the advice of some of its own independent directors who are meant to be on that board precisely to provide a bit of a check and balance over the partners that run these big consulting firms. And they're defying the advice of a number of those directors by not handing this over. Eventually, by the end of the session, when Martin Shepherd, the current KPMG chair, was called back into the stand, he made some noises that at least part of this advice or investigations or reports may be handed over to the committee on the condition that it remains confidential and that KPMG can maintain their privilege in terms of other parties, because I think they're also clearly worried about potential legal ramifications, including, you'd have to say, from the way that whistleblower was treated, you'd have to think they'd be looking at their options about, you know, compensation. Because as they told the committee chair, you know, who'd do this? Like, if I'd known what was going to happen from blowing the whistle in the way I did, would I have done it? Probably not.
Obviously, not only the private pressure that this person appears to have been under, but now how much damage it probably has done to their career and all the other ramifications.
Well, it's one of the things that also caused outrage is the revelation that KPMG appears to have used the threat of withholding a reference for this person if they didn't basically settle this issue. You know, the use of non-disclosure agreements, not only in these big partnerships, but more generally in the corporate setting, when you've got people exiting firms who have allegations against the firm or against individuals within a big firm, that also came under criticism, including from the corporate regulator ASIC. And then the other big overarching issue, which does specifically relate to the big four accounting consulting firms, Deloitte, KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and EY, is that they operate in a legal grey area. So even though ASIC was giving evidence, ASIC has very little enforcement powers over these firms.
Because of the partner model.
Because they're a limited liability partnership rather than a corporation regulated under the Corporations Act, which ASIC is responsible for upholding. And there will no doubt be a significant focus of this inquiry on whether those laws need to be changed to ensure proper regulation of these firms. Let's not forget that they audit something like 97% of the ASX 300 companies. So these four firms have incredible power. That's aside from all the work they do in consulting for the government, for big corporations. They are the gatekeepers of corporate Australia and making sure that companies are honest with their shareholders, honest with their creditors, doing the right thing and not getting into serious financial trouble. They are the transparency in the market. It is critical that people can trust these firms, and at the heart of this is a complete loss of trust in KPMG.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's see how this plays out over the coming weeks. I don't think this issue is obviously finished with, and it does appear that there are many senators who really believe that there needs to be follow-up to ensure that something changes and that this doesn't occur again.
And it's across all parties as well, the coalition senators as well as Barbara Pocock from the Greens and Labor Senator Deb O'Neill are really all united at seeing this as a very serious issue. So I don't think KPMG can count on this going away.
That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We will be back in your feeds with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to send us in your tax questions as we're hard at work on a series of bonus episodes all about tax ready to hit your feeds next week. You can drop us a line or a voice note at ABC Business Daily at abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Michael.
See you, Carrington.